This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Okay, everybody, good evening. Welcome to the People Speak Radio Show. It's your host again, Charles Giuliani. We're going to be joined today by a very important guest, Michael Parenti. He's the author of a new book, author of several books, but his latest book, which we'll be talking about, is The Face of Imperialism. So without any further ado, let's welcome Mr. Parenti. Welcome, sir.
Hello, how are you, Charles?
Great to have you on. Yeah, I've read several of your works. I'm sure many of the listeners are familiar with you. But for those that aren't, why don't you give us a little background on yourself, and then we can launch into our discussion about your latest book here.
Well, I've written 24 books, and the Face of Imperialism is the most recent. It came out last year, actually. And the books all deal with political, economic issues, cultural, historical, various subjects like that. If people want more information on me, they can go to my website, which is michaelparenti.org, O-R-G, you know, www.michaelparenti.org. And there are also articles there that can be read and the like, hundreds of articles. Been in academia for a number of years. My work is used sometimes in colleges, but I also have a lay readership, non-academic readership.
I remember the first time I interviewed you, this always stuck in my mind. It was pretty funny. You called yourself a recovering academic.
Yes, that's what I am, a recovering academic. I've been thrown out of some of the best universities in America because of my political activities. It's a myth to say that that academia is a hotbed of radicalism, leftism, and all that, or even liberalism. But a lot of academia is very prohibitive and very restrictive and very intolerant of dissenting views, that conventional views are much more readily received than critical or dissenting ones, which is too bad because we need not only intellectuals, we need what Antonio Gramsci called the public intellectuals. That is, the intellectual who wrote learned things, but not for five other dreary colleagues of his, but for the public, that is, who wrote and thought and debated about issues of the day, of the year, of the society, but issues that were urgent and important and of vital thrust. So there wasn't always that much tolerance for the public intellectual. But what it did do is it brought me to a wider readership, really, to a wider public of my own.
So, yeah, it actually backfired in the long run and served your interests. But, yeah, people, a lot of people aren't aware of any mechanism of suppression at all in any educational institution. But for those that are aware, they usually attribute that to, you know, public schools, high schools. They don't carry that over. They don't believe it carries over into higher schools of learning, but it really does, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it does. Well, what carries over to high school? Well,
control of information suppression. What you experienced yourself, yeah. You know, being blackballed, basically, the trying to prevent you from, sharing certain facts with your students.
Yeah, and it does seem that all institutions seem to have their first view seems to be to protect the interests of the institution. You know, we see this with the church, too. We see it with all sorts of groups of people who are kept out, who might have something really creative to say. You see it in things, Charlie, you see it in things like the medical profession.
Oh, sure.
Psychiatric profession, too. Someone will come up with a new treatment, you know, and if it bumps up against entrenched interests and entrenched methodologies and big pharma, multi-million-dollar markets and all that, you may run into trouble. You may suddenly find the FDA crashing down your door and say, "Oh, you got a treatment here? Well, we don't think it's legitimate." No.
Under the color of protecting public interest, they're actually protecting monopolies.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah, under the guise of protecting public interest, they're protecting the entrenched interest, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's sad, but it, across the board, that's how it works.
Yes. In this book, The Face of Imperialism, what I try to do is show that the United States has a global empire like no other that they ever had in the world, that this empire does not represent or protect the interests of the American people. We have something like, about 750 bases around the world, on every continent of the world, and hundreds of countries. We have fleets, battle performance fleets that call a port just about every continent of the world, and sail every ocean of the world, and so forth. And one wonders, why do we need all this? It's an enormous expense. It's a crippling expense. Dwight Eisenhower talked about it back in the late 50s, 1950s, about the military-industrial complex. And
sure.
For every gun, every bullet, every bomb is one less bit of food or schooling or something for civil society. So the empire feeds off the republic. The empire consumes enormous, enormous amounts of wealth. Just look at your budgets next time. $1 trillion it really comes to, if you count also some of the Department of Energy military expenditures, and you count the part of the national debt that's that goes for that's due to war to pay for past, present, and future wars, and even just right in the enumerated budget. I think it's up to about what, $800 billion by now. And this Obama is no different from the people before him. He is looking for ways to cut back on human services, and he's constantly looking for ways to please big, powerful conservative interests and increasing the spending of the empire. So that's the book is about that, which is the cost of empire, and it raises questions like, why? Why do we have an empire? Why do we need this? Norway doesn't seem to need this. Denmark doesn't. Nor does Iran or Iraq or Russia or all those countries that the U.S. accuses of being aggrandizing and expansionist and all that. They're really not. They're not doing those things. They're not trying to take over the entire Middle East. They're not trying to take over Africa or Asia or all of Latin America and the like. I argue that this empire represents the interests of corporate monopoly capital, and that's what its goal is. It is to make sure that no other forms of social organization fail, that any country that tries to
aspire,
you know, expand and use the land, the labor, the natural resources, the markets, the capital, to use those things to develop an alternative social order, one that's egalitarian, one that's communal, one that rules out the IMF and the World Bank and doesn't want big capital coming in. Any country that tries to make it on its own and go in that direction, that country will be designated a target of the United States and will be seen as an enemy of the United States and will be targeted and taken out. And that's true of a huge country like Indonesia, where Lyndon Johnson backed a massive Indonesian army slaughter and takeover, hundreds of thousands of people arrested and executed back in 1968. A big country like that, or a tiny little country like Grenada. No country is too small to be stamped out. Ronald Reagan went in and invaded Grenada, took it over. All the communal farming that they had started and all was wiped out. No communal farming. No. This country, you leave it open for the commercial farming that we want to do here and what we want to bring in or not bring in. And so it was. It was serving notice to every other country in the Caribbean that if you try to do what Grenada does, we will stamp you out. And George Herbert Walker Bush invading and bombing Panama and bombing El Cheria, the working class district of El Cheria, killing thousands, hundreds of people in the bombing. And all the while lying to the American people and saying, this country, that country, other country, it's a threat to the United States. He's hostile to the United States.
Even in State Department documents, Zbigniew Brzezinski and some of his books have actually come right out and stated emphatically that, you know, we need to portray ourselves as on the edge, ready to snap at any given moment, irrational, to put fear in, you know, other leaders to get them to comply. Brzezinski has talked about how we need to prevent the barbarians from coming together. You know, that's basically the summation of our foreign policy, and that's how it's played out.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, if you take that view, Charles, then you're saying, well, our policy is crazy, it's mistaken, all that. I'm saying underneath that, there's a very rational policy, and very consistent, that anybody, whether the guy is a dictator or democratically elected, whether he's from Latin America or Africa, Asia, wherever, that any leader, any movement, that really tries to use its resources in a new, in a different mode of development, more collectivist mode, not for profit, not for capital accumulation, but for the well-being of its people. Anybody who does that will be designated, like Hugo Chavez, for instance, in Venezuela. Sure. He gave subsidized oil to people in New England, Citgo. It was Venezuelan's oil company. People who were too poor to heat their houses and all got the oil free, almost free.
Do you have your suspicions about his death?
What?
Do you have your suspicions about his death?
I most definitely have suspicions about his death. He himself had suspicions about his death. We know that they have developed ways of causing heart attacks and causing cancer. When, you know, he had cancer. Dilma Rousseff, who was the president of Brazil, running and looks like she's the lead candidate to win the presidency of Brazil, she suddenly got cancer. She still went ahead, survived, and she's in there. Lula, who was president, couldn't run anymore because he had cancer of the throat. Santos, who was a conservative in Colombia, but he was doing things like coming to an agreement with Chavez on the border there, on the Colombian-Venezuelan border, that they would get along with each other. And he was doing a number of other things. He was calling for peace and an armistice and that sort of thing. He gets cancer all of a sudden. Lugo, Bishop Lugo of Paraguay, Bishop Lugo left the clergy and ran in politics and became president of Paraguay, and he got cancer. They got him out on a sort of a constitutional coup in Paraguay. He was very popular, and he was really doing some real reforms. And so you're saying, well, what are the odds? What are the odds? Right. Venezuela, Paraguay, two in Brazil. Oh, Argentina, Kirchner. Fernandez Kirchner. She got cancer. Her husband took over. He was a young, vital guy when he first took over as president of Argentina, and he dies of a heart attack. Then she runs, and she gets elected, and she gets cancer.
Yeah.
So that's Argentina,
been going on
Brazil,
for a long
Venezuela,
time.
Colombia, Teddy Holmes,
and Paraguay. The president of Panama back in the early 80s, they claimed that his plane crashed into the side of a mountain, and yet hundreds of witnesses said they saw the plane explode in midair and then crash into the mountain.
Well, who is this you're talking about?
Torrijos, the president of Panama?
Yes, Torrijos, definitely. And Torrijos was suffering from, he himself said he was suffering from nightmares about crashing in a plane. It had just happened to the guy in Ecuador.
Yeah.
Same thing. A reformist president whose plane blew up. Their planes blew up just like a matter of weeks apart from each other. And planes don't just blow up in midair, you know. The report was, just as you said, that the plane crashed into the side of the mountain. Eyewitness reports say that it blew up in midair and then just came down. Yeah.
This happens far more frequently than people care to realize. And not just in other countries. Political dissidents here have disappeared or died under mysterious...
Paul Wellstone, who had the deciding vote on some issues there in the Senate, and was a real progressive and militant. His plane, the first story we got was very bad weather, and I said, bull, I don't believe the weather was bad. And they had to drop that story because weather reports had already gotten out, and the weather was fine. So then who said a bad weather? Who planted that story? We don't know. The second was pilot error. They just couldn't clear the trees or this or that. And in fact, since those reports came out, there are all sorts of eyewitnesses have come forth and said that the plane looked like it was completely out of control, just getting out of control and wobbling and struggling.
JFK Jr.
Pardon me?
JFK Jr. is highly mysterious circumstances around his death.
Really? I thought his plane, I thought, wasn't. I thought that was just bad weather and bad flying on his part.
It actually was neither upon closer inspection. That's another story. I don't know if we want to get off into that. That's off the topic of your book. But the one big mystery with that
is... Well, I do deal with, in my book, Dirty Truths, I deal with another airplane crash, and that was Walter Ruther. Walter Ruther was president of the United Auto Workers and a very progressive labor union leader. Mm. He had already had two attempts on his life. Somebody shot at him through his window and got him in his arm and chest, I think. He never got full use of his arm. His brother Victor was shot in his house and lost the use of his eye. I met Victor, and his eye was he had it fogged over with his glasses. Both of them were outspoken, progressive people. Walter Ruther had left the AFL-CIO. Oh, and they both were in a plane, and the plane had developed altimeter problems. The altimeter, for your guests, for your listeners, is the measurement of altitude. That's all. And they had a mistake, and the pilots at the very last minute were able to pull it up over the treetops and land it safely. But there it was, and that's with Walter Ruther and Victor. They were almost killed. Some years later, when Walter, not long after Walter, took the United Auto Workers out of the AFL-CIA and formed an independent third union organization with the AFL and the Teamsters, this scared the hell and came out against the war in Vietnam and was very political. This scared the hell out of Richard Nixon, who who designated Walter Ruth as the most dangerous man in America. And in a matter of a week or so after he announced this, fingered Ruth in this way, Ruth's plane with I think his wife and an assistant and the two pilots, it crashed. Crashed, and it was the same thing again. The altimeter had been tampered with, and there were all sorts of things missing and loose in it. And obviously, Walter Ruth was killed. The Transportation Safety Board had this finding about the altimeter and then proceeded to ignore its findings and declare it was an accident.
They do so often.
It's kind of remarkable. I got the whole case in my book, Dirty Truth. It's just one chapter in a book of all sorts of other incidents and things.
Yeah, TWA 800, they did the same thing. They suppressed evidence of explosive residue on some of the seats.
TWA 800, was that the Lockerbie? No.
No. Off the coast of Long Island in the summer of...
Oh, that one. That was very strange. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was very strange. There were people who said they saw a missile streaking through the air, and that could have been a mix-up. I mean, that could have been a real accident where they took out a civilian airliner by mistake. And then
regardless
had to
why it happened, they covered it up, as always.
They had to cover that one over. The U.S. Navy was... was looking pretty bad. Well, let's get to the conclusion. Well, the conclusion is that they do not hesitate to kill people and cover up killings if this means advancing the power and influence and securing the legitimation of the powers that be against people who are seen as troublemakers or difficult or representing interests that are really in the public interest, that are reformist, progressive interests. I mean, what was Walter Ruth's big sin? His big sin was that he wanted people to be paid a decent wage. He wanted the U.S. to stop spending money bombing and killing and destroying people throughout Indochina and start spending that money on the well-being of people in America. We would have been a stronger, safer country if we had never fought in that Vietnam War. And even today, now you got to, and I mean this very week or so, you had the 10th year anniversary of the Iraqi War, and you get these pundits on the air who say, it's been a mistake. It's a mistake. And I'm saying, it was no mistake. They want this war. They had planned this war. The think tank, the right-wing Bush-Cheney think tanks had published that Rebuilding America's Defense, PNAC, I forget it.
Project for the New American Century.
Thank you. Project for the New American Century had already published Rebuilding America's Defenses a year before 9/11. Year before, saying that Iraq
called for a new
was
Pearl
a threat.
Harbor.
What?
They called for a new Pearl Harbor type event.
Right. They said what we have to do is mobilize American feelings and sympathy and support, and that'll take a new Pearl Harbor, something of the magnitude, of the magnitude of a Pearl Harbor will get them. And they got it, didn't they, in 9/11?
Well, you remember what Brzezinski said in his 97 book, The Grand Chessboard?
What did he say?
He talked about the need to go into Eurasia, i.e. Afghanistan, in the coming years for the same reason, to secure the oil and natural gas in the Caspian Sea. He mentioned the rich mineral resources in the mountains of Tora Bora, blah, blah, blah. He said on page 211, to do this, to get the American public behind us in support of this agenda, it would require, quote, a massive, widely perceived direct external threat.
Exactly, and they were running out of threats. They had, for 100 years, they had talked about the communists, the anarchists, and then the communists. I was raised on that. You remember that, too, Charles.
Sure.
I mean, not at my age, but remember communists here, communists in our schools, communists in Hollywood, calling communists in the army, communists
McCarthyism.
Communists under your bed, communists going to get your mama, all of that. And then when the communist countries all folded up there, there was a while there they were desperately looking, and they started talking about terrorists. And now it's terrorists, and the terrorists here and the terrorists there. And Saddam Hussein was part of Al-Qaeda. He wasn't part of Al-Qaeda. I'll tell you who was behind much of Al-Qaeda, and that was the U.S. National Security State and the CIA in Afghanistan.
Yeah,
they're the ones
absolutely.
Who trained most of those killers.
And the Bushes and their Saudi buddies.
What?
And the Bush family and their Saudi allies.
Oh, yeah, Bush family and their Saudi allies. Saudi Arabia has backed more terrorists and jihadists than Saddam Hussein ever did.
Yeah.
And by the way, the people will say, well, look, we need the acquisition of that oil. I want that oil for my car and to heat my house. And so, but that wasn't the issue at all. Saddam Hussein was just the opposite, just the contrary. Saddam Hussein's grievance was that he didn't get enough quota of the oil market. And by that, I mean enough to sell. He wanted to be able to sell more. And Bush Sr., the old man, who was an oil man himself, as his sons were, Bush Sr. said, if Saddam's oil gets on the market, the price of oil is going to just crash, and we don't want it. I read that, right? It was right in the business section of either the Washington Post or I don't remember. I think it was the New York Times. I've got it cited somewhere in one of my books. But the whole thing is not to make sure we get those resources so we can help the American people and make sure they get what's needed. It's to monopolize and control the markets and the prices and the profit flow. They don't care about oil. They care about the profits that oil brings. They don't care about coal. They don't care about agriculture. They don't care about cars. They don't care about anything. They only care about those things in terms of how much profit they produce.
Yeah.
And that's the essence of capitalism, which is to take living nature and transform it into into commodities, and then from commodities into dead capital, into piles and piles of bonds and notes and gold and.
And like you mentioned earlier, the medical profession, it's the same thing. You know, they're not interested in cures. There's no money in cures. They want to keep you sick and keep giving you treatments, coming back for more, and, you know, keep the money rolling until your dying day.
Yes, and if anybody has a special interest in that subject, please, again, go to my website, www.michaelparenti.org. And on there I have two articles. One of them is called Free Market Medicine, a Personal Account, and it's about my experiences that I had with some medical stuff. And the second article was Free Market Experiences, I forget what I call it, but Other People's Stories, that's what it really amounted to. The second one, so many people wrote in to me and gave me accounts of the treatments that they've had, terrible treatments, or if they were abroad, if they were in places like France or even Canada or Denmark, whatever, they had much better. They told how their treatments were much better, much less, and that sort of thing. Interesting accounts, very interesting. Well, one woman was in for a gallbladder thing just one morning. She was in, and they sonically broke the gallbladder stone, and she was out by noon. She was in for a matter of less than maybe 12 hours or something, and she got the bill, and it said $51,000 was the bill she got. She thought it was a typo that you know, it should have been $5,100. She went in and then almost fainted when she heard it was $51,000. And Blue Cross covered her, and then the fight became the hospital versus Blue Cross, and I think they got it down to some smaller amount, and they paid that. And then guess what Blue Cross did to her? They dropped her. And that's the insurance, that's the health insurance companies. They want you only if you're healthy and you pay up and you don't ever have to use the insurance.
Yeah,
once you start using it, they drop you.
What a rotten fraud. Everything works that way today. It's so disgusting.
It is, and with medicine it's especially disgusting. Because it's one thing if they do it when they sell you shoes and try to make the shoes look sharp and this and
right,
that.
Right, but your own health, your life.
It's another thing when it's your life and death or the life and death of your loved ones or your children, and they're there making profits on it, and that's all they're worried about.
Mr. Parenti, we're going to cut for a short break here. We're at the halfway point, but stick with us, folks. Lots more important information when we get back.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests from various realms of interest share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson for Normal. And like millions of other responsible Americans, I smoke pot. There's nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana. And it's none of the government's business. Let's get the government out of our private lives once and for all and stop arresting smokers. Let's take a stand for personal freedom. To learn how you can help, go to normal.org.
Come, you masters of war.
Hello, this is Cindy Sheehan. America's war on terror has become a war of terror, with endless drone bombings, continuing military occupation, as well as detention, rendition, and torture still being practiced under the current administration. I lost my precious son Casey to war, and now work towards a day when not one more mother, son, or daughter will suffer such a loss. Listen to my podcast, read my blog, and come join me at any activities I attend near you. Please visit CindySheehanSoapbox.com for more information, and let's work for peace together.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. When I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to BBSRadio.com.
Okay, everybody, welcome back. Once again, we're joined by Dr. Michael Parenti. He's the author of 20-plus books. This latest one came out last year. It's called The Face of Imperialism. We've been talking about that. His website is Michael Parenti, PARENTI.org. You can go there and look at many of his fascinating articles. And I'm sure there's links there as well to your books, I'm sure. Is that correct?
Pardon me?
Do you have links, you know, for people want to order your books, or they can probably just go to Amazon.com and look them up?
No, they probably go to, Ex Libris or Amazon or one of the other.
Yeah, they can just type in your name there and see the titles that you have. Mm-hmm. We got some questions that have been coming in. Before we get to that, though, I wanted...
Charles, just one second. Let me see. Hello?
Yeah. Did you switch lines?
I didn't cut you off.
No.
I think this is better. Is it a little better?
Yeah. I mean, the other one wasn't bad, but this is even
okay.
a little clearer. Sure. I was looking at some of the chapter titles in your latest book here. Chapter 3 asks why U.S. rulers seek global domination. We pretty much covered that. I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to add to that, but basically you're arguing that power for the sake of preserving monopolies and profits?
Right. It's not just power for power's sake. It's power for a very real class interest, power involving hundreds of billions of dollars. And they'll spend hundreds of billions of our dollars, the taxpayers, to protect their billions, many billions of dollars also.
Yeah. And, of course, now we're seeing this thing come to a head to where our economy is going down the chute.
Yes.
And it's all because of this raping, really, of America to benefit the interest of the few, primarily through, like you said, you know, what Eisenhower had, the term he coined, the military-industrial complex.
Yes, really. And what it needs for that is enemies without end. I think I got a section in that chapter, too, that is enemies. The empire will tolerate or will perceive, I should say, the empire perceives only two kinds of nations around. Ones that are their satellites, sometimes they're called allies, too. So I either the satellites or enemies or potential enemies. If you're not a satellite, if you're not, in other words, if I don't have you in my pocket, you know, if I don't have you under my foot, then you're a potential threat to me, and I'll watch out for you. And that's the way it is. The countries that are trying
to set an example out of you, you know, make an example.
Well, Iraq was an example. That's
exactly
the point. I mean, the irony is this. Saddam Hussein was created by the CIA. For the last 15 years or more of, or 20 years of more of conflict with him, the media has not once ever mentioned that back in the late 50s, early 60s, Saddam Hussein was CIA. He was put forth by the CIA. His first gig, his first job was to assassinate the democratically elected president, or prime minister, I think it was, of Iraq. He shot him, but he didn't kill him. The CIA hustled him out of the country to a safe house someplace. Later on, he ended up taking over the Ba'ath Party with enough resources, with enough guns at his command and enough money. And he wiped out the whole left wing of the Ba'athist Party, and he killed every constitutionalist, every Democrat, every socialist, every communist. He killed them all. And in those years when he was doing that with the CIA, he was Washington's poster boy. They loved him. They even sigged him in a war against Iran. And he did it for them. But when he started getting out of line on the oil quotas, which I just mentioned to you a while ago, where he wanted a more decent cut of the oil industry, and when he refused to hand over the oil back to the British and American oil companies, but he kept it publicly owned for Iraq. In other words, Saddam Hussein started committing economic nationalism. He was a nationalist. He wasn't the communist. He wasn't this or that. He was a nationalist. The economy in Iraq remained publicly owned, most of it. This was crazy. The U.S. said, what are you doing? Will we put you in there so that you'll privatize everything and you let the American companies own it all? And that's that. That's the kind of world we're building. And they didn't say it in quite those words. But and that's when he suddenly became a murderer. And he had been a murderer. I'm not saying this guy was great. But that's what Washington loved him. When he was first cleaning up the place and wiping out the reformists and the revolutionaries and the lefties, he was killing people and murdering them and torturing them. They loved him. They talked about him as an ally, as one of our guys. He loves America. They never explain when they say someone is hostile to America or someone likes America and he's our friend. What do you mean? What is the framework of interest involved there? They reduce it all to very simple things like attitude or personalities or something. And the whole goal is to scare the American public, not tell them what the real interests are involved here, and therefore get people to back another war in another place. I mean, how many wars are we going to be fighting? And with this Obama, this Barack Obama guy who likes to salute American flags that are draped over coffins that are coming back home, and he stands there and he salutes them grandstanding away, and we all go, ooh, look at the president. Oh yeah, he feels it. Yeah. What is that? What is that all about? He doesn't. He's not serving the interests of the American people or the interests of the Iraqi people. And the same with Iran now. Now they're targeting Iran as next on the list, the hit list. Meanwhile, he's fighting. Where else is he fighting? They've been hitting drones in Yemen. They've been hitting drones in West Pakistan. Of course, the war in Afghanistan is still going on in places like Somalia. And
it's kind of discouraging, isn't it? You know, you would like to think that your fellow countrymen have some degree of intelligence, but the fact that they can fall for it, it's so very transparent.
It's the same story every time.
Yeah, sure.
Charles, it's the same story every time. Noriega was the same. Noriega didn't want to play ball with the U.S. in fighting against Nicaragua. Noriega kept Torrijos' left military reformist country that it had. They had to get rid of Noriega.
They had no problem with his drug dealing. He dealt drugs alongside with the CIA all during the 80s. You know, later in the end, he wasn't playing ball anymore. So now they demonized him as a drugs trafficker. You know.
Exactly right. Yeah. You're talking about Noriega, right?
Noriega, yeah.
And you know what else? They also demonized him as an admirer of Hitler. And what did they find in his secret headquarters? An old Life magazine, among a number of other old magazines, and on the cover was a picture of Adolf Hitler. Well, that's Life magazine had a picture, and they used this, and they had shots of it and everything, saying Noriega was an admirer, a secret admirer of Hitler. And they get the people bugged out of their heads that, you know, he's going to get you. Watch out. You got the world is full of these creepy enemies, and we've got to go and fight and kill and bomb these villages and countries way on the other side of the world, killing people who couldn't even find America on a map, let alone are out to kill it and undo it. And you're right, it's the same scenario again and again, and it's one does have to marvel at the way our compatriots fall for that story again and again.
Yeah, propaganda extraordinaire. Anyway, the last segment here, the last 15 minutes, I should say, we got some questions I thought we could get to here before time runs out. This first one comes from Loon in Texas, who asks if you could give your summation of your definition of imperialism.
Yes, imperialism is when the ruling interests of one or several related governments, nations, the ruling political-economic interests of the country go out and they expropriate the land, the labor, the natural resources, and the markets of other countries and other areas for the purpose of capital accumulation for themselves. And to prevent reformist or alternative forms of government to emerge. So you do not allow the country you're expropriating, whose resources and labor you're expropriating, you do not allow it to invest and develop in its own way and in its own direction. Walter Rodney wrote a book about Africa, about European imperialism of Africa, and he called it How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. What's interesting is the use of the word of underdeveloped as a verb. He didn't say Africa was primitive and underdeveloped and Europe went in and tried to, you know, they don't go into these countries to spend money on them and try to uplift the people there. They go in to take it out.
Sure.
And those countries were developing on their own. Those countries that developed hides, for instance, were learning to tan the hides, and that tanning the hides, making shoes and purses and things. They were developing, and when they started developing, they often were slammed back down. Frederick Engels talked about this back in 1870 or so, 1860, about Ireland, his trips to Ireland, where he said, whenever the Irish have gathered together and tried to build something or make something better, the British came in and stamped it down and kept them down. And that's the goal, is to keep you, the hungrier they can keep you, the poorer. poorer they can keep you, the poorer and hungrier you are, the harder you will work for less and less. Just remember that. And the goal is always that, to roll it back so that I get what I want. I'm not going to spend money on stupid, foolish things like wage increases and your holiday, paid holidays, or your health benefits, or occupational safety, or environmental protection. Every dollar I got to spend on stupid things like that is one less dollar for me. And there's only one thing that the ruling interests have ever wanted, and that's everything. They want everything. They want all the herds, all the wealth, all the resources, all the choice lands and whatever else.
They literally do. And when they get everything, that won't be enough. They'll look for new things they can steal and hoard and deprive you of.
That's right. They will create new needs. They'll tell you you need glass shoulder blades.
It was that their philosophy is akin to the Roman who said, "It's not enough that I win; everybody else must lose." That's about it.
Yes.
Anyway, you kind of already answered this. Some of these questions might make us become redundant here. But anyway, John in Canada asks, Noam Chomsky claims that the conventional role of the elite is to advance their own, advance and promote their own perspective and agenda. Do you agree with Noam Chomsky on this? You've pretty much laid that out already.
Well, I think all of us left critics, progressive critics of U.S. imperialism have made this focal point. Yeah, and Noam, of course.
He stated that emphatically. We have another one here. This is Miriam, and quite a few Canada questions coming in tonight. Miriam in Canada asks, what does Dr. Parenti think about QE3, which is quantitative easing 3? Are you familiar with that?
You know, I'm not familiar with that.
I must say, neither am I. I'm not sure what exactly that is. Well, we got another one coming in here. This is Mike in California. He asks, does Dr. Parenti think that there's any way of salvaging the U.S. from economic collapse and the oppression of its people by its own government? Do you think it's revolution, peaceful, or non-peaceful?
I think we need mass action. We need popular actions to turn things around, and those popular actions must have a massive base. And, you know, we have evidence that they do. You could say, yeah, dream on, Parenti. Yeah, dream on, Charlie. Yeah, right, Juliana. But the truth is, the Occupy movement, it came out of nowhere. Nowhere. I mean, at a time when everybody thought nothing's happening, nothing's moving, and there it was suddenly. And it came forth, and the critique it had was very class-oriented. It addressed the great class divide in this country. It said there's the 1%, and then there's the 99%. And they were suppressed, you know, and they were stopped. But we would need that. We would need more leadership, more organization, more coordination, resistance. We would need to organize in the ranks of the military, get the military out of these places like Iraq and Afghanistan. Why are those people killing and getting killed and destroying? Look what's happened to Iraq. I mean, half that country has been killed or injured or driven into exile or driven into total desperate poverty. The communities, the utilities, the services, the running water, all sorts of things, electricity, everything, living in misery and want and desperation, all this because of the U.S. going in. And the U.S. went in after the whole world demonstrated against that sort of thing. People all over, from Japan to Mexico to Finland, all around the world. I never saw that before in my life, of demonstrations against the war before the war ever took place. And we went through all of that, and yet there they go, killing people. And this is the kind of thing we've got to focus on. We need new ideological education, a better critical understanding. Now, how do we get that? when the other side has all the money, all the resources, controls the networks and all that. Whatever little resources we have, we should try to use as much and as best we can. But, you know, I remember when Richard Nixon had to give up and sign a peace agreement on Vietnam because the U.S. Army wasn't fighting anymore. The platoon level, even companies, a couple of companies mutinied. They refused to make contact with the enemy. They were not fighting, and they knew they had the backup. They had the backup, the whole American public who were turned against the war and was sick of it and didn't want it. What we have to do is not just resist these actions, but also put forth an analysis about who's running things, who rules everything. The American people actually know more than they let on, than they allow themselves to think about. You know, they do know that that there's a tremendous gap between that 1% and the 99%. They do know that it's a tiny number. It's really not even 1%. It's less than 1%. 1% would be about 3 million people. It's more like about 200,000 families or people or people, 200,000 or so, are among the super rich, the very super rich, the Waltons, the, you know, and the others like that. They need to be prosecuted. Many of them, instead of being held, should be in jail. I mean, it's
absolutely
quite obvious. I mean,
yeah.
That's another terrible crime. None of them gone to jail. And that's Obama's work or lack of working. I mean, even under Bush, you got Ken Lay was put in jail, and Andrew Fastow, and
you know, it's quite a game they play, because you know they'll get a sleazeball Republican like Bush in there, and everybody demands change, and they go to the polls, and they get what they think is going to be the antithesis of that guy. And when do people wake up, Dr. Parenti, and realize that? Whether it's Republicans, Democrats, left, right, conservatives, or liberals, these people are hand-picked ahead of time. They're corporate whores. When does America wake up and realize this?
Well, that's very true. They are cleared. They are cleared by people. These guys, now we're called conspiracy kooks if we say that. Whenever
reality.
You ascribe conscious direction or forethought to people who have billions of dollars to defend and protect and advance,
yeah.
You're called a conspiracy theorist. Well, that's crazy. You mean farmers can watch out for their interests, and school teachers can watch out for their interests and want a better contract or this and that, and coal miners. But if you suggest that the people who own and run most of America, who sit on the boards of directors of all our corporations, our networks, our museums, our cultural institutions, our major universities and such, they are on the boards of directors of all of these small groups of people, multiple positions they'll even have, and who have immense amounts of money. When you suggest that they are concerned about who is going to run and who isn't going to run, the Koch brothers, you know, what they're putting out hundreds of millions of dollars. You don't think they ask? Oh, by the way, who's getting this money? You know, of course, they are spending, and they are thinking about, and they're meeting. You know, I remember back in 90 or so. I'm blanking out. See, this is what happens. What is it? That group that Rockefeller runs and
Trilateral.
Like the Trilateral Commission was the Bilderberg Conference.
Oh, all right. Yeah.
I got back in those days. This was before the internet. It would have come on to me over online. I got a printout of it. Thick printout of who attended the Bilderberg Conference, people from all these various nations, all these rich counts, this, that, CEOs. I turned to the United States, and the first name there was no surprise. It was David Rockefeller of Rockefeller Brothers, New York City. And the second name was the Honorable William Jefferson Clinton, governor of Arkansas.
Vegas.
And I said, what the hell is the governor of Arkansas doing at the Bilderberg? I mean, he's just a backwater. And I'll tell you, like a few months later, this Clinton is declaring himself a candidate for the Democratic nomination, and he's being designated in the media as the front runner.
Oh, you're really becoming a conspiracy theorist now.
What?
I said you're really becoming a conspiracy theorist now. It's true. This is how it works.
I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I mean, it was right there. It was all happening in front of me.
Yeah. It's amazing, though, just by using those that term, conspiracy theorist, it's designed to discredit you without people actually looking into what you're saying to see that, my God, he's right. This is happening, you know.
Well, there are conspiracies. If by conspiracy you mean people who plan in secrecy, usually with forethought, to advance their interests, of course,
that's
happening all the time.
Sure. I tell you what, we're actually running out of time here, unfortunately. I just wanted to mention one last thing. That question, the QE3, I guess, refers to bank
Queen
bailouts.
Elizabeth?
What's that?
Does it refer to the Queen Elizabeth?
No, I guess it's a term that she says is used synonymously with bank bailout. So I guess that's what she was asking you. What do you think of the bailouts?
Oh, the bailouts. Well, the bailouts were... It's not that they're too big to fail. They're too big to be allowed to fail.
Yeah,
because,
right.
That's who we obey, and that's who pay. That's who pay. I mean,
big money calls the shots.
Barack Obama's largest contributor was Goldman Sachs when he first ran for president.
And they played a big role in that debacle. Anyway, unfortunately, Dr. Parent, we've run out of time. I want to thank you, though, for taking time out and joining us. Very interesting information. Once again, folks, go to his website, michaelparenti.org. Or you can just go to Amazon.com, type his name in, and see his books that are available. The one we've been talking about, as well as several others he's written over the years. Very, very good, very informative stuff. Can we look forward to another book coming up in the near future?
Yes, well, we have one coming out. I have one coming out in a few months. It's called Waiting for Yesterday, Pages from a Street Kid's Life. It's actually about my life in New York. Italian Harlem, where I was born and raised, the family, the church, the school, the street, you know. I had a lot of fun writing it, and it's coming out. People who read it really enjoyed it.
Okay, well, thanks again, Dr. Parenti. Hate to cut you off, but we're really out of time.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Okay, folks, next week we're going to be joined by Anna Balzer, author of Witness in Palestine. She's going to be talking about her work with the Palestinian people and the oppression that they've been suffering in the Gaza Strip. So we'll see you then. Take care.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.